Hi, I'm Joel Greenberg. I'm at Bletchley Park today following the opening of an exhibition about Gordon Welshman, one of the key people at Bletchley Park during World War II. My privilege to be sitting with James Thirsk, who actually worked with Gordon Welshman in Hut 6. A nice way to start is to ask you, Jimmy, how you felt about the security. In other words, when did you feel that you could actually start talking about this stuff?
Well, after Winterbottom's book, The Ultra Secret, came out in 1974, I think it was published in America, but just before it came out here. But when it came out in 74, Winterbottom revealed most of what was going on. He didn't go into the mathematical details of how Enigma was cracked. I think a lot of his information was not strictly true because he was writing it from memory only. But after that, I felt I could tell people who asked me. Before that, often people who knew I'd been in the intelligence corps, I mean, during the war, when I was at home on leave with my parents, people would see me in the street, an old friend, and say, "What are you doing now?" And I used to say, "Well, actually, I was originally with the Central Party," which Welshman mentions. Central Party was at Bow Manor in Leicestershire. After I'd been there a month, we came over to Bletchley and attached to Hut 6. So the name Central Party was lost then. But I used to say to people, "Well, I'm with MI8 Communications," because Central Party was actually part of MI8, which was Communications. That usually satisfied people.
But what about later? I mean, when did you think you could actually write your own memoir?
Well, I don't remember really. I'd written a couple of books of childhood and boyhood reminiscences, which came out before this. And then I began to have these memories of Bletchley and different stories and some funny. And I got the idea of also incorporating biographies of the leading people, not just Welshman and Turing, but I finished up with 50 short biographies, which comprises half the book, really, which is, I thought, useful because the names of Turing were so well known, but other names were not known so well, except by people who were at Bletchley. And I'd been collecting obituary notices that came out, and after Winterbottom, the obituary notices came out, all mentioned Bletchley, but before Winterbottom, those who died earlier, Bletchley, of course, was not mentioned.
No.
But the other point was that in my book, I've got a separate chapter on the fact that secrecy was not complete after the war, and that many journalists and writers referred to Bletchley, not necessarily by name, but some even Muggeridge mentioned the name Bletchley. Because although Malcolm Muggeridge, the journalist, he was in intelligence during the war, he never served at Bletchley, but he did visit here apparently once. And he talked quite freely about this a couple of years before Winterbottom.
There was actually a book published in 1986, which you can still buy secondhand, called The Philby Conspiracy,
Oh,
by Sunday Times journalists, where they go in great detail about Bletchley Park breaking naval codes. But it slipped under the radar, and I suspect it was the fact that Winterbottom's book was serialized in the Sunday Telegraph.
And Trevor Roper mentioned it as well. And also, not many people know this, but in the Pearl Harbor hearings, which account after the war in America, they had these numerous investigations into Pearl Harbor. There's a whole shelf full of volumes about it. And I saw these at Chatham House and went through them and didn't read them all, but I skimmed through them and found that there was some references, even in 1946, about the fact that the British had been breaking German ciphers. They didn't mention it by name, Enigma, but it was mentioned. And they pleaded with Senator Dewey, I think it was, who was up for president. And he didn't get it, fortunately. He knew about the secret during the war, and they pleaded with him not to released a letter, but he disregarded it and released this letter. I can't remember all the details, but it revealed that the British had told the Americans that they were breaking Enigma, and it didn't mention the name Enigma, but it said, if this letter is published, we are compromising our position with the British about the secrecy and so on. And then it appeared in Time magazine and Life magazine, brief extracts about this. You see. Well, people read these things, and if they don't know the background, it flows over them.
Okay, so when the Hut 6 story came out, I mean, what did you think when that came out? Did you think that Welshman Jimmy had revealed secrets that he shouldn't have revealed? Or?
No, I bought the book when it came out and read it, and no, it didn't strike me that he'd revealed anything he shouldn't have done, because I knew this background of all these revelations that had been made before, and I couldn't understand what the fuss was about later on.
Because I'm so interested in the traffic analysis side and in the log reading, I mean, can you give us to me just some idea of the scale of it? Because I understand it was like the logs, there's information associated with tens of thousands of messages being logged.
Oh, yes, it was an avalanche. It was like Niagara. The intercept operators all over the country, they had two pads. They put the messages down on one pad. They were normally sent originally by dispatch rider, but I think the urgency of the messages, they were sent by teleprinter. But the logs themselves, which is all the other material, what Gordon Welshman called chit-chat between German operators, keeping in touch with each other, their headquarters and their outstation, to keep in touch all day long by using the Q code, which was an international three-letter code, a Morse code, QZA, was what is your signal strength? And these logs came in by dispatch rider, motorbike with two big panniers on the side. And I remember in the room where they were received, and the door opened, it was a winter at Bletchley, and a dispatch rider came in. He was covered from head to foot with snow and carrying these two pannier bags and dumped them on. He shook the snow off him. You know. He'd driven probably 60 miles through a terrible snowstorm. You know, the mail must go through. And the logs were not all that urgent. The messages were, but not the logs. We were quite a large group of people, 50 or 60, working different shift systems as well. But you had pigeonholes, and these logs were sorted out by frequency, I think. So if you were on the day shift, you went in at 9, went to your pigeonhole, do up. You hoped a slim collection of logs, but sometimes it was this thick, sort of groaned as you, because you had to go through every log and make notes and draw diagrams of who was talking to whom, using coloured pencils for different messages and so on. They often got 2 days off, moving from evening to night shift or night shift to day shift. You sort of wangled a couple of nights away, went off to London to the theatre and stayed a night in the YMCA or something like that. And you came back. Nobody had bothered to touch your logs. They were overflowing in the pigeonhole. You just had a great stack to deal with. I used to keep a diary in those days, just a pocket diary, a few brief comments about going out to the pub in the evening and that sort of thing. And sometimes I would put, shattered at work today, worked on till 5:30 before I finished. It was dull work and it was very monotonous. At that time, we didn't know that Enigma was being broken. We knew there were messages going, and we used to speculate among ourselves whether these were being broken. But at Bow Manor, there was a separate room, and the people inside were in the know, and we weren't. And we weren't allowed in that room. But they came out to consult us about some call sign or other, or some network, and then they would go back. They wouldn't tell us a thing. So we got very suspicious about this. Anyway, we'd been 6 months at Bletchley, and I think Gordon and Welshman had been advocating that the loggery should be told. And he gathers together in one of the huts, about 50 of us, I remember, and just told us the whole story about Enigma and how it was being broken. And of course, this gave a terrific boost to our morale, because then we could consult with the people in what they call later the fusion room. They were fusing information from the German messages with our information about networks and traffic analysis. And my future wife was in the fusion rooms. She was using her German, she had been studying German, to analyze contents of German messages. And they had a vast card index of names and places. And everything that was going on was noted on cards and then fused with our information from traffic analysis. And the results were put on a big wall map. Gordon Welsman, in his book, towards the end, he says that the central party attached to Hut 6 probably knew more about the Enigma transmission apparatus in Germany than the Germans themselves. And I thought that was a lovely quote.
Mm.
I think there's still a lot of mysteries about intelligence during the war. For example, were the Russians also breaking Enigma? It's never been revealed.
Mm.
Even the doctored messages to the commanders in the field, like Montgomery or Eisenhower or any Patton or any of the others. Montgomery obviously knew, and probably his right-hand man knew, but nobody else. Mm-hmm. And the special liaison units attached to each commander in the field, they knew the information and passed it on. But it didn't go any further at all.
Yeah.
And they were very careful about this.
I mean, for me, the best evidence that the Germans didn't know that the Enigma was compromised was that whenever they did enhance security, which you would do as a matter of course anyway, they would send out instructions to the operators telling them what changes were about to be made, encrypting them with the existing system. So you all knew in advance that they were about to change something. So that's pretty good evidence that they really didn't believe that the system was compromised.
The other thing that a lot of people don't know is that over a whole year they'd been studying call signs, and they were able to predict and make a call sign book, because the German operator of a particular station would say call sign GHQ. Next day he would look in the book and find his call sign for the next day, change at midnight. Well, apparently two or three of them had been working on this for a whole year, and they worked out so they could predict what the call sign would be. And they'd only just completed that when the Russians captured one of these call signs books and handed it to the British. So we had it anyway. And
it's called the Bird Book.
The Bird Book. One of my frequent memories about Bletchley, we only had one copy of the Bird Book. And of course, every day, all the log readers wanted to use it to find out the change in call sound. And it was kept on a central desk. And then you'd suddenly hear someone, has anybody seen the Bird Book? And some guilty person who'd kept it on their desk, you know, failed to return it. It was passed around all the time, so it was well thumbed.
Well, it still exists. It's at GCHQ. That's been really a good chat. It's just wonderful to bring multiple generations together. Gordon Welsman obviously was the reason we were all here today at Bletchley Park. Lovely to have former colleagues of his here. Lovely gathering.
It's a pity we haven't something strong to drink.
Oh, that would be nice.
I couldn't agree more.
Yes.
With water, a little toast to Gordon Welsman. Yes. Well, sir.
Cheers. Thanks.